Previously on Accused.
I'll tell you, if anybody's listening to this podcast or whatever, do not believe somebody who is in jail who said your client or my client confessed to them.
Yeah, it was just amazing information that he provided.
Well, we've had and snitch testimony in other cases that has fallen apart too. So, I mean, the fact that he wasn't honest was not surprising, but the part about the how orchestrated it
right.
was.
I'm Amber Hunt, and this is Accused, the unsolved murder of Rita Welch. Reading through the newspaper coverage of Newport in April 1987, you would never know that anyone had tried to connect the police shooting of Isaac Grubbs with the nearby stabbing death of Rita Welch. Both were big news at the time, with headlines about them appearing in the same day's edition on several occasions. But they were always separate headlines. Even Robert Patton, the lawyer who had represented Grubbs before his death and who was representing William Virgil in Rita's murder case, hadn't considered a connection until he finally got those additional police files on the eve of the trial. Remember, those were the files that were not labeled GJ for grand jury, and it's because of those files that the trial was delayed 5 months so Patton could try to find any evidence connecting Isaac Grubbs with Rita Welch. Well, he found some.
She was the best witness I'd ever had on the witness stand.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
There's more?
Yeah, there's more stuff.
Wow. Are there any, are there photos?
With boxes with photos, but everything's all jumbled up.
So how would we go about requesting those? And I'm not,
I don't know. My supervisor's not here, so.
If you listen to the previous season of Accused, you'll know all too well how tough it is to investigate a decades-old case. In the Elizabeth Andes case, some of our key players were dead after nearly 40 years. Some we couldn't locate, and the evidence is still, so far as we know, missing. We thought when we tackled Rita's case, we would fare a bit better. There was a conviction this time and several subsequent court filings. Most evidence was recovered, though in a strange coincidence, it had been lost for a few years before someone found it in an attic. Still, there was enough for new DNA testing. And most promising to us, the case was 10 years fresher, which we thought might mean that we would find more people alive and willing to talk. But Rita was older than Beth when she died. Beth would be 60 today, and Rita, 84. Many of Rita's friends are dead. Her children believe William Virgil is guilty and aren't keen to talk to us. And prosecutors in this case aren't willing to say much on the record. Additionally, a lot of the players in this case weren't leading the types of lives Beth's friends lead today. They were immersed in a criminal world back then, and many of them remain there today, making their lives inherently transient. I have never hit so many walls in trying to find legitimate addresses or phone numbers.
Hi, I'm trying to...
Is not available.
Oh.
The mailbox is full and cannot accept any messages at this time.
Oh my goodness!
Goodbye.
But I expect these problems. People move, they get married, things change. What I wasn't expecting was trouble finding simple court records. I know Isaac Grubbs had a record because Patton remembers representing him. I'm assured this is true by the news release that announced Grubbs' death. It states Grubbs had an active warrant out for violating his probation connected to an aggravated burglary conviction. The last line of the release is, quote, "Suspect has an extensive arrest record," end quote. But somehow those records aren't in the Campbell County Courthouse archives.
Okay. Do you know if the other ones are back there, or might they be somewhere else?
I don't know.
The voice you hear is Kimberly Armstrong, a former Enquirer intern who helped me research elements of this case. Campbell County is a bit behind the times, so you have to go in person to search old cases. I had done it already and failed to find anything for Grubbs, but that was earlier in the reporting, so Kim went armed with a few more names and dates to see if she would get luckier than I had been.
So I know you said that you didn't know where the microfilm might be, but do you know who I could contact?
It shouldn't be in microfilm, I don't think. Because I have all the way back to 85. It's mm-hmm. either missing, a quick look in here, it's mm-hmm. in here.
In short, this is what we were told. Cases as old as Grubbs might not be stored in the computer system. Rather, they might be kept only on microfilm. Okay, we said, let's look at that then. But they don't know where the microfilm might be stored. So Grubbs' records are missing, at least for now. That might not seem like a huge deal, but whoever killed Retha Welch had been vicious about it. It was the kind of crime you wouldn't expect of, say, a one-time car thief. Whoever did this was likely prone to violence. That's why I'd like a clearer picture of Grubbs' criminal past. In the days after Grubbs was shot, Newport Chief Rick Huck told reporters that the slain man had an extensive police record, including numerous charges and conviction for terroristic, threatening, assault, and trespass. He was convicted of third-degree burglary and sent to LaGrange State Reformatory in 1977. And then there was the outstanding warrant because of a probation violation related to the aggravated burglary. If all of this is true, it doesn't help me understand why police didn't consider him worth looking at in Retha's death. And make no mistake, he wasn't looked at seriously. His name was in her file, but Detective Norm Wagner testified that despite Grubbs' being raised as a suspect, he wasn't investigated. I'd like to know why. Without specifics of Grubbs' past to look at, we're left only to examine his last day alive. A woman named Karen Walling called police a few days after Grubbs was killed. Walling had just learned about Retha's death and said she had made a startling connection between the two events. Walling owned Bell Acres Twin Lakes, a fishing lake and clubhouse near Southgate, Kentucky. It was a pay lake, meaning that customers paid up to $5 to fish for 12 hours. They would catch as many fish as they could, and they could come and go throughout the day, so long as it was within that 12 hours of buying their ticket. Walling had seen Grubbs there several times, she said, sometimes with his family. And she said he was there April 11th, 1987, the day he ultimately was shot dead by police. Walling said that he was the first customer that day, in fact, and he stood out for more reasons than that. He was glassy-eyed and clearly intoxicated. She could smell alcohol on his breath, she said. He stood out, too, for his unkempt appearance. He wore a blue plaid shirt that, she said, looked as though he had slept in it. Now, the Bell Acres fishing hole didn't have a public phone, and this predated cell phones, so when customers wanted to make a call, they would tell Walling the number to dial. And she would dial it and listen for a hello, and then hand the phone over to the person requesting the call. Grubbs seemed irate when he arrived this Saturday, and he asked Walling to dial the phone. Walling did, heard a woman say hello, and handed the phone to Grubbs. None of this was terribly unusual, but elements were just off enough that the situation stuck in Walling's mind. Walling usually put a 3-minute time limit on these phone calls, and she remembered Grubbs' call lasting between 10 and 15 minutes. She was starting to get peeved, but she didn't dare order him to cut it short because he seemed unhinged. He was screaming into the phone, saying things like, "I'll take care of you later," and "I'm coming over now." Walling said, quote, "I was literally scared to death of him," end quote. Grubbs dropped the phone at some point and rushed out of the clubhouse. He seemed to tear out of the place. Later, he came back, and he asked Walling to dial the same number again. It stuck in her memory, 491-0559.
She said she had a really good mind, never wrote the numbers down, didn't have to. She just knew them and always remembered them. And she was good. Wow.
Walling again waited for a hello, and she heard the same female voice answer a second time. The conversation was argumentative. Walling said she was fixated on Grubbs' glazed eyes. Quote, after the phone call, they were different. I was afraid of him because of the way he was looking, end quote. It didn't help that Grubbs had a big knife in a leather case sticking out of his belt. After both phone calls, Walling said Grubbs left the fishing lake. Because he had a day-long ticket, he could come and go as he pleased and not check back in. But she's sure he left twice, and both times he returned. When he was there, he caught her eye. She said, I'm death on drugs. Anybody with glassy eyes, I look them up and down. Photographic memory of exactly the way they look. Plus, he drew attention to himself by bringing in outside beer, which wasn't allowed. She admonished him twice, and he was unpleasant each time. Finally, he readied to leave before dusk. He was still drunk, drunk enough that he got his black van stuck in the mud and needed help. Walling's husband, Charlie, came out to tow him, and Grubbs finally went on his way. Walling said the next time she saw him, he was on the news, being carried off in a stretcher. Within minutes of leaving the fishing lake for good, he was shot and killed by police officers. But that didn't prompt Walling to call in. The shooting wasn't on her property, and she didn't have anything to add. It seemed to her he must have been as irate with the cops as he had been in her shop all day. It wasn't until later, when she learned that Retha Welch had died, that she started to wonder if she knew more than she realized. She remembered the phone number she had dialed, so she looked up Retha in the phone book. There it was, 491-0559. She called the police. She testified, I told them the fellow that was on the stretcher that died Saturday night was fishing at my lake, and that he had me dial this lady's phone number. She was sure that they would want to talk to her, so she left her address, her work phone number, and her home number. No one called for months. By the time they did call, Virgil was on the eve of his trial, and police didn't seem interested in what Walling had to say about Grubbs. In fact, the police only circled back to her after the defense lawyer got that box of documents pointing to alternate suspects, the one labeled GJ. When it was clear Patton was going to look at Grubbs, police finally asked Walling what she had called them about all those months earlier. Then they quickly dismissed what she said. Patton says Walling was one of the best witnesses he had not just in this case, but in any case, because she wasn't connected to either the suspect or the victim and had no motivation to lie. Plus, that memory of hers was astounding, he said. To me, it seemed a bit far-fetched that a woman would remember a phone number she dialed days after the fact, even if she dialed it twice. For me to buy that as a possibility, I would need to know somehow that Walling's memory was indeed freakishly good, and I can't ask her because she died in 2014. So I tried to reach her family.
So back in 1987, there was a murder. And in 88, your mom testified because she thought that the gentleman who might have had played a role in it, that he had been at her fishing lake that day. Does any of this ring a bell?
Yes.
Okay.
This is Linda K. Spurlock, one of Walling's daughters. She spoke about her mom with a reverence I can only hope my child has for me when I'm gone. She said her mother was righteous and brave and had helped save lives during the infamous 1977 Cincinnati Supper Club fire that left 165 people dead. And she had other stories about her mom, like how she hated drugs so much that she once turned over a pot plant to Southgate police when she found it growing near the fishing lake, and then was appalled to learn from her police officer husband that his colleagues had divvied up and smoked the thing. I asked Linda about her mother's memory.
I'm trying to piece together because it would have been an extraordinary feat of memory for her to hold on
my
to
mom,
phone number.
It would just take one glance at a license plate or whatever. If somebody tells me a number,
I have my mom's same memory, and I love that memory because I don't forget numbers at all. If you were to tell me your number, I wouldn't have to write it down. It's only if I don't need to remember it that I block it out.
Wow.
So I can look at someone's license. Oh, yeah, my mom was really good at that. I took after her.
I didn't expect Linda to remember this case. She wasn't directly involved, and it seemed feasible that her mom didn't talk to her much about that time in 88 she testified in a murder trial. But Linda actually remembered it well.
Do you remember her talking about this case at all?
Yeah, I grew up on that fishing lake. That's where we were raised at.
Did she ever, I mean, because the person that she thought did it, you know, he was already dead and somebody else went to prison for this. Did she ever talk about?
Yeah, her and my stepdad always talked about it.
What would they say?
Her. I mean, she would always be upset about it because she didn't think it was right that someone innocent got arrested for something that they didn't do.
So it seems Karen Walling was pretty certain. That said, eyewitness identification is incredibly faulty, we know now. Hundreds of scientific studies have pointed to it being notoriously unreliable. The Innocence Project says that bad IDs were a factor in more than 70% of wrongful conviction cases. A Florida chapter of the group, in fact, posted a piece in 2012 that called eyewitness ID the most unreliable form of evidence. I teach this to college journalism students, in fact. Take a look at one of your friend's Facebook pictures. Spend 1 minute studying a background character's face, then go do the dishes and maybe watch a TV show, and then try to jot down what you remember about the person you had studied. How many details do you flub? It was certainly in Walling's favor that the man she believed was Grubbs did things to make himself stand out to her, asking for special attention to use the phone, then staying longer on it than he was allowed, plus getting stuck in the mud at the day's end. Walling also said she had seen Grubbs before, and if she had, that would make it a bit more likely that his face would have accurately been emblazoned on her brain. To try to back up what she said, I read the investigation into Grubbs' death to look for any corroboration between it and what Walling described that day. Unfortunately, the report provided is pretty anemic. It doesn't mention how Grubbs got to the spot where he ultimately was shot dead by police. It describes him wearing boots and jeans, which roughly matches what Walling described, but it doesn't describe a shirt at all, much less a blue plaid one like Walling remembered. A photo I have of Grubbs at the scene isn't helpful either. It shows a wound in his neck, but his shoulders are bare. I don't know if he was shirtless when he arrived to where he was going, or if medics tore off his shirt to try to save his life. Walling said the man at the fishing lake had a knife, but she said it was in a leather sheath. The knife found on Grubbs was something akin to a butcher's knife, but with the tip broken off, and it didn't have a sheath at all.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is your last chance to save 65% on a full year of BODi. I'm Carl, co-founder of BODi. That's B-O-D-I. And I want to help you lean into your decision to start working out and eating better. Right now, if you sign up for a one-year subscription to BODi, I'll give you 65% off. Look, I know it's not easy to get fit and lose weight, especially if you're trying to figure it out by yourself. But we make it simple. Just follow a program for 20 to 30 minutes day by day and lose 5 to 10 pounds a month. We have over 120 programs that have been tested and proven to work, and almost 300,000 five-star reviews in the App Store to prove it. BODi also has complete eating plans and thousands of healthy, delicious recipes. So stop guessing and start seeing results with BODi. And let me give you 65% off right now so you save big on the app that CNN underscored named Best Fitness App. But the sale ends this week, so don't wait. Sign up for a year of BODi and save 65%. Just go to BODi.com. That's B-O-D-I with an I.com.
During Walling's testimony, prosecutor Hoot Ebert didn't spend much time exploring whether the man at the fishing lake was Grubbs at all. He dismissed Walling over one discrepancy. Walling estimated that she and her husband were helping pull the man's van from the mud at about 7:30 p.m., and Grubbs was shot dead at 7:23 p.m. But then Walling wasn't married to the time. She said she was estimating because it was still light outside and the sun set at maybe 8 this day in April 1987. I checked, and in fact, the sun set at 8:11 p.m. Walling wasn't basing her time estimate on a clock, but rather on the fact that it was still light out, though it wouldn't be for long. The fishing hole was 10 minutes from where Grubbs was shot, and his death was pretty quick once he arrived. But what was Grubbs up to that day? Newspaper stories after his death quote his parents as saying Grubbs was going to work on his girlfriend's car. Lonzo King, Grubbs' stepfather, said that at about 6:40 p.m., Grubbs had come to his home about a quarter mile from where he would be shot dead. Grubbs drank some wine and asked to borrow tools to work on the car. King told the reporter that he didn't have a small knife, so he gave Grubbs a butcher knife to trim car wires. About a half hour later, a woman called police reporting an unwanted guest. She said this man she didn't know showed up looking for her daughter with a knife. He had a crazy look in his eye, the woman told reporters. According to police reports, officers arrived, Grubbs lunged, and they shot him four times. One bullet pierced his throat, and he was pronounced dead on arrival by doctors at a nearby hospital. It took a lot of digging to figure out who Grubbs was trying to visit, the daughter referenced in the news stories. The mother quoted has died, and her obituary indicates she had six daughters. The one Grubbs wanted to see wasn't publicly named back then, and her surname has changed in the years since. But I found her. We'll call her Rachel, because she's asked me not to publicize her identity, mostly because this was a long time ago, and her kids don't know the story.
Do you know why he showed up that night?
Long time ago, really not getting into it, you know, but from my understanding, he was drunk, you know, and had a knife and had tried to attack some police officers. I mean, you're talking how many years ago?
The more Rachel talked, the more I understood that what had happened all those years ago was traumatizing for her. She used the guarded language that's used by women who've been abused. She didn't say straight away what had happened. The story trickled out bit by bit. She doesn't remember where she met Grubbs.
Honestly, no. Isn't it?
But they dated for 6 to 8 weeks. She was drawn to him in part because she felt sorry for him.
Here's exactly what she said. He said, you know, I would love to be loved just for me. He said, I don't think I've ever had that in my life. He said, not even for my mom. And I said, do you have kids? And he said, yeah, I have a son. I said, then you are loved. I said, because your kids love you regardless of who you are, what you do, you know, and are you that bad of a person? And he said, at one time I might have been. He said, but it's hard to change when everybody keeps pulling you back to the same old thing. And I just felt sorry for him.
Yeah.
You know, and then we talked and it went from there, you know, and we just started going out. And then it's like, holy hell, you know, you're full of shit and stuff, you know, and it's like he presented himself one way and then really was another.
Wow. Okay.
Rachel doesn't remember the name of Grubbs' son or the child's mother, and I haven't been able to find either. Mostly she remembers Grubbs as a sad character, someone who never had a chance.
I did kind of feel sorry for him to some extent because when I met his mom told me that she used to put whiskey in his and his siblings' bottles when they were babies to get them to sleep. Who does that? To me, she made him an alcoholic before he was even walking.
Oh, my gosh.
You know, now that's a story she told me, not him. She did.
And it was always, alcohol was his vice?
Yeah.
Did he use anything else?
I could tell you because I only seen him like 2 months. Past that, you know, it was done. I've seen him about total about 6 to 8 weeks.
Wow. And it's a dramatic 6 to 8 weeks.
Oh my God! Yeah.
You meet a guy, he's violent toward you. You break it off.
To look back, you know, it seemed like at the time like it had been so much longer. I was so tired. It was like, God, this just got to be over and done. You know, no more. I mean, I felt like, you know, I'd been doing it for my whole life with him, but in reality, I hadn't.
Wow.
But even when he died, it bothered me because I thought, you know, his whole life, what kind of life had he really been raised with? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
He was raised to be an alcoholic.
Wow.
I mean, who puts whiskey in a baby's bottle?
Grubbs had marveled at Rachel's upbringing. He told her she was raised in a fairy tale. At first, Rachel scoffed. Her dad was not one to spare the rod, after all. But after she learned more about Grubbs' upbringing, she realized that, compared to his childhood, hers was idyllic.
You know, I had food on the table. He said, you know, you had food on the table, you had clothes given to you. I never got that. And the more, you know, I heard from his siblings, and even his mom, you know, they had to go out and steal chicken eggs and stuff, and chickens and stuff back in Perry County where they came from to even be able to eat. And he would talk and just laugh. Like, that was one of the best memories, going to a store to steal meat and getting by with it, you know. He said,
wow.
We ate good that night, didn't we? You know, I mean, and that was just, to me, so sad. And when you're raised like that, what, I mean, you don't know no better.
Right.
And for some reason, I felt like, you know, if I would show him, you know, there was a different life. But I guess he didn't, I don't know if he was just so bad on, gone on, you know, the alcohol was just so bad on his mind or what. But he, you know, he just, I guess he didn't want a different life. I don't really know. I just know, you know, I could not help him. And the more I tried, the worse it was. And it's just like I just couldn't do it no more.
Wow.
But to this day, you know, I still feel sorry for him to some extent. Even though, you know, he was violent and stuff, I look back and I think, God, you know, I don't know. It's just he couldn't have had the best of life.
Rachel wouldn't go into specifics, but she said that Grubbs had hurt her. When she realized violence was going to be a part of their relationship, she ended things.
It's just he was violent, you know, and I was just done and over.
And you didn't.
He wasn't.
He wanted to keep the relationship going, and you were breaking it off.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. And it was just like, you know, and to him, I didn't give him time to change or anything else. But to me, I didn't have time, you know, wasn't enough time to even, what time I had went with him. Was not a good experience, you know.
So that's what Rachel says Grubbs was doing on April 11th, 1987. She had broken up with him, and he was looking for her. She was hiding from him because he wasn't taking the breakup well, and she worried he would be violent again. He showed up at her friend Jean's house looking for her. Rachel said she believes that's where he got the butcher knife he would later have in his hand when police shot him.
Oh, goodness.
And,
you were in trouble that day.
You know,
was he he was looking to hurt you that day?
I don't know that. I mean,
you were afraid, though.
So.
Okay.
She was in hiding. She had never taken him to her home, and to this day, she doesn't know how he knew her address. But he showed up at her mother's house with a knife, and Rachel's mother, not knowing that this wild-eyed man screaming on her lawn had been dating her daughter, called police for help. They came, he lunged, and he died. I told Rachel about Retha Welch's death, which she said she hadn't heard about before, at least not that she remembered, and certainly not in relation to Isaac Grubbs. I told her that Grubbs' name had been suggested by defense lawyers as the culprit. Rachel said, well, it's possible.
I could tell you that he was violent when, you know, he was drinking. Very violent. Could he have hurt somebody? Yeah.
Okay. I mean, that tells me something. I'm saying a woman was murdered and you can't say, oh, he would never do that.
Right. I cannot, no.
That says something.
Now, if he had been sober, I don't think he would have.
But when he was
definitely. And he was drinking that night, so he could have.
Because she was in hiding, she doesn't know precisely what he was doing with the rest of his day. They weren't hanging out together, after all. But she's certain he wasn't fishing. She saw him briefly and says she knows he was drinking, and that part of the day he was at his parents' house. She knows he stopped by her friend Jean's house. Fishing just didn't seem to be on the agenda. As with many elements of this case, this should have been easy to figure out back in 1987, or even the next year for the trial. Maybe Walling got the days wrong and Grubbs was there Friday instead of Saturday. I could imagine that days running a fishing lake might bleed together a bit. Maybe everything else about her memory is accurate, the phone number, the screaming calls. But maybe it was Friday instead of Saturday. Or maybe she got it all wrong and her amazing memory wasn't quite as flawless as her daughter thinks. Either way, this isn't the only possible connection to Aretha's death that Patton uncovered in time for Virgil's trial. He found another that he couldn't use in court.
And then, to make it worse, and this is one I'm going to tell it for posterity here, I had, that was being covered somewhere in the newspaper, in the defense, and I had a fellow come in to, that I happen to know, who was a criminal, and he happened to be a half-brother by a different name to Isaac Grubbs. And he said, yeah, Isaac came up to me, and he said, I want you to burn these clothing for me. I've gotten an altercation or something with a lady down at the Yacht and Tennis Club. And he said, I might have killed her. I said, okay, great. You're going on, Bill. His name was William, and his name was Hensley, I believe it was. So I said, I'm going to put you on. He said, no, I can't do that. I said, what do you mean? Well, we're suing the police, so the family won't let me testify to it. I said, you're going on, Billy or William. You're going to go.
He refused, Patton said. Patton's story is impossible to verify without talking to the brother. I found that Isaac Grubbs had a half-brother named Billy Ray. Grubbs' mother at some point went by the surname Hensley. This was after she had born Grubbs, but before she married Lonzo King, the stepfather quoted in the stories after Grubbs' death. After cross-referencing some birth certificates and criminal court records, I felt comfortable I had verified Patton's memory of a half-brother. His name was Billy Ray Hensley. Knowing a name isn't always enough, though. I used a few public information databases and found Billy Ray Hensley about 3 hours from me in Hardeeville, Kentucky. His age was about right, and one of the public listings said he used to live in Newport. I called and sent Facebook messages, but he didn't respond. So Kimberly Armstrong, the intern, and I hopped in my car and started driving.
Yeah, Kim is the orange car. All right, so I am mapping it out.
Starting route to Billy Ray Hensley's home. Head south on Victor Street, then turn right onto Warner's.
Oh, this is weird. It's a good thing I'm so friendly. Guess I don't need to leave a note. All right, bring a notebook, bring a pen. I have one more recorder for you.
The audio of me approaching isn't the best. It was really windy outside, and I didn't take the time to adjust levels as the crowd of clearly suspicious people eyed Kim and me as we approached.
Hi. Sorry. It's a little weird. I'm looking for Billy Hensley. I'm looking for Billy Ray Hensley.
We don't live here.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Do you know where he is? Because it says Hensley on the...
Yeah, but he's not here right now.
Okay, but it's... Oh, no, I'm a reporter. I'm not a salesperson. Pardon?
What kind of reporter?
A news reporter. I've been trying to reach Mr. Hensley.
What for?
It's actually not about him. It's about his late brother.
At first, they said Billy Ray wasn't there. Turned out he was sitting right with them. But still... It ended up being the wrong Billy Ray Hensley. I don't share this audio to drag out what turned out to be a wasted 7-hour trip. I know from hearing from people after season one that young journalists listen to these types of podcasts, so I include this to make it clear. Sometimes when you're reporting, you hit dead ends. It sucks, but it's necessary. Kim and I were able to knock one Billy Ray Hensley off the list. A few days later, I found the right Billy Ray. He had just been arrested in Louisville, Kentucky on a minor charge. The birth date matched the Billy Ray that Patton had represented all those years ago, and based on his many mugshots, he even looks like Isaac Grubbs. I was relieved to find him, but I couldn't exactly celebrate. Billy Ray pops in and out of jail often, usually for the types of crimes associated with someone who gets himself in trouble by drinking too much. I can't find a fixed address for him. I tried to set up an interview with him while he was being held in jail on a $200 bond he apparently couldn't afford, but he was released before I got permission. I haven't been able to find him since.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
There are two more witnesses from Virgil's trial worth mentioning here. One is Brian A. Cave, another inmate. We've talked about jailhouse informants testifying for the prosecution being unreliable, but there's much less research on the reliability of convicts testifying for the defense. So, weigh this how you choose. Cave was in the Newport jail at the same time that Virgil had been held for violating parole by leaving the state. He heard about Virgil's case and said he remembered something that he thought might be important. Cave had been in Covington, a few miles away from Newport, on April 11, 1987, the Saturday Isaac Grubbs was shot dead. Cave was there between 1 and 1:30 p.m. and saw a gentleman in a pink Cadillac. Cave said he didn't think much of it at first, but then he noticed that the man who parked the car spent several minutes wiping it down both inside and out with a rag. He testified, "Not too many people get out of the car and wipe the car down and then, as they take a couple of steps, look around like somebody's following them or looking at them." He described the car cleaner as a white man with blondish brown hair, about 160 pounds. He needed a shave and had a mustache, and he was wearing a blue plaid shirt with blue jeans and white sneakers. Patton showed Cave a photo of Grubbs, and Cave said, "Yeah, that looks like him, but with darker hair." He remembered the guy with the pink Cadillac as being sandy blonde. Prosecutor Ebert dismissed Cave by taking a jab at Karen Walling, too. He said, "We just had a witness in here with a photographic memory, and I assume you have the same type of memory?" In closing arguments, Ebert said Cave was a liar. Retha Welch's pink Cadillac was found in Covington the day after her body was discovered in Newport. The car had been wiped clean. A Wiedemann's beer bottle was recovered as evidence, but that's it. The second witness worth mentioning is a neighbor of Retha's named Richard Beale. Some longtime residents might recognize the name because Beale's son, Dickie Beale, was a University of Kentucky basketball star in the 80s. The elder Beale lived in the same apartment complex as Retha. He lived directly beneath her, and he could often hear her walking around upstairs. He said he heard her Thursday, April 9th. He said he heard footsteps Friday, too, and early Saturday. On Saturday afternoon, between 12:40 and 12:45 p.m., he spotted Retha's pink Cadillac leaving the parking lot. He couldn't see well, but he could tell it wasn't Retha behind the wheel. The driver appeared to be male and was wearing some kind of plaid shirt that Beale thought was either blue or gray. Beale said it was odd because it looked as though the driver was intentionally hiding his face. Beale didn't hear footsteps upstairs again until Tuesday, when Rita's body was found. There would be a simple way to test out the theory that Grubbs was Rita's killer even today, 30 years later. He had a knife, after all, and the defense theory is that perhaps he used that same knife on Rita Welch. With today's heightened DNA testing, investigators could simply test the knife to see if traces of Rita's blood are still on it. If they weren't, it wouldn't eliminate Grubbs entirely, but if they were there, we'd have an undeniable link between the two. Unlike in Beth Andy's case last season, this one has evidence still available. Granted, it was lost for a while. I'll talk about that next episode. But I won't drag out the ending. The evidence eventually was found in an attic. Swabs from Rita's rape kit examination were recovered, as were the bloody bathroom rugs and two knives collected from her apartment. Everything was there, except the knife that Isaac Grubbs had on him when he died. Lawyer Elliot Slosar worked for years to find that knife, which had been Defense Exhibit Number 6. Adam Hill of the Campbell County Prosecutor's Office sent him an email in August 2016 with some confounding news. The knife had been destroyed some 10 to 15 years prior. Hill said it wasn't a targeted thing, but rather a general order that addressed property from multiple old cases. And in fairness, it wouldn't have been unheard of. The case was long solved. The appeals had failed, so it would have been feasible that a court order aiming to clean out some space might have inadvertently included some evidence from a high-profile murder case. But Hill was wrong. He eventually found the court order to destroy the knife and passed that along to Slosar. The order wasn't general at all. Dated February 4th, 2005, the document states plainly, "It is ordered that the Campbell County Sheriff's Department shall destroy the knife that was used as evidence in the above-captioned case." It was signed by Judge Leonard L. Kapowski. This order is tough to understand. Three knives were collected in the Rita Welch case, but only one was destroyed, the one belonging to a man that the defense highlighted as an alternate suspect. Why did law enforcement go out of its way to destroy this one knife? When I first heard Slosar in court talking about police framing William Virgil, I winced. I've covered some questionable police work during my reporting career, but it's usually been sloppy or lazy at worst, not malicious. I still don't know what happened in Virgil's case, but after reporting this case for nearly a year, I don't blame Slosar for using the F word. That's framed, not the other one. The reason I get it is because of the timeline. Rita died in 1987. Virgil was convicted in 88. In 91, he confirmed that Joe Womack had perjured himself. In 2004, the state appellate court ruled that perjury didn't matter. Virgil and his lawyers had raised Isaac Grubbs as an alternate theory in the filings that reached the appellate court. And then immediately after that decision came down, police moved to destroy the one piece of evidence that could have confirmed Grubbs' involvement. It's the only piece of evidence in the whole case that they asked to destroy, and it wasn't part of a broad order. It was targeted. Slosar wants to know why.
What is the innocent explanation for doing this? For giving them, you know, benefit of the doubt? How does it make sense to do that?
The innocent explanation would be that they wanted to free up storage space.
You hear some background noise here because we were talking as Slosar awaited his flight in the Cincinnati airport. A man at the next table was jingling his keys.
And we're looking for a
knife was taking up a lot of space.
I mean, I think that's the only argument they had. I mean, the problem for them was that there were other knives that they could have destroyed. There were other larger items of physical evidence that they could have destroyed, and they chose not to. You know, they chose to seek the destruction and actually destroy the single weapon that was recovered from an alternate suspect who was killed by Newport police officers.
This knife destruction is at the heart of the pending civil litigation, but we're sticking to the criminal case here. It wasn't the knife that sprung Virgil from prison. It was Retha's rape kit, which the state of Kentucky fought tooth and nail to keep from being tested, and almost won. Next time on Accused.
You need to do work. Investigate everything yourself. That's what we're supposed to do. You can't just rely on the papers you get, you know, or on a police detective saying something. You have to go out and actually investigate it yourself. That's part of your duty.
This is a special project by the Cincinnati Enquirer and Cincinnati.com, reported and narrated by Amber Hunt, edited by Amy Wilson, produced by Amanda Rossman and Phil Didion. Music was composed by Andrew Higley. Kimberly Armstrong assisted with research. For photos, documents, and more, go to accusedpodcast.com.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.